The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
What would you give up to be at the birth of your first child? And then, should a pastor ever retire? A well-known pastor weighs in on that. You're listening to The Common Good. Hey everybody, welcome back to The Common Good. You're on AIM 1160, Hope for Your Life. My name is Brian Fromm. Glad to have you with us on this Monday afternoon. It's just a beautiful weekend, right? It was just a gorgeous weekend. Literally hit 80 degrees yesterday. And I think about today and I go, okay, it's kind of like, what's great, what's not so great? What are the great things, what aren't? So let's just talk very personally, right? We could talk much on a grander scale about what's happening in Israel or, you know, whatever else it might be. But this weekend, beautiful weather. Hopefully you got outside. Hopefully you were out there doing your thing. I got to mow the lawn this weekend. It's a highlight of mine. Like that first, I talked about it at our church yesterday, but that first mowing of the lawn in the spring, it's like we've made it through the winter. I know there could still be snow coming down the road, but that first time you mow the lawn where you're like, man, my lawn needs to be mowed. I went out with the mower, started first time, actually found some gas. I wasn't sure that I had gas in the shed. Mowed the lawn, listened to a podcast. You're like, okay, spring has come. Summer has come. Like, there's not many better places in our country than this time of year or the fall in Chicagoland, right? Baseball is getting going. So all of that is good stuff. Hopefully you had a great day at church on Sunday. Hopefully you made it to worship. And I know at our church, we're in week two of our new church, the Grove Church here in Downers Grove. Two churches merging to become one. And fantastic. Lots of people back again. One of the things we loved about this new church building that we were able to merge into is there's this big playground outside. And it was like 80 degrees yesterday. So there's all these kids outside playing. It was fantastic. So there's all this good stuff going on. All of this exciting stuff you could see. Summer right around the corner. Now let's take the negative turn. Today's tax day. Today is tax day. Have you gotten your taxes? And I was up late doing ours last night. And it's always a stressful time for many of you. It brings up all sorts of anxiety of like, oh, do I owe? Do I not owe? Do I pay someone to do it? Do I not pay someone to do it? It's tax day. I heard somebody say today that because of income tax, that especially in a state like Illinois, you work the first 4 or 5 months of the year just for the government, and then you start making your own money. So that becomes a big deal this time of day. Today, April the 15th, not only are we halfway through the month of April, but it is tax day. So happy tax day to you and to yours. Celebrate the way that you celebrate. Maybe you're getting a big return. And that is reason for celebration. Hope that you're having a great day. The other thing that happened this weekend for many of us is watching the Masters. This is another rite of spring. And even if you're not a golf fan, the Masters might be one of the best sporting events that you could watch, let alone go to, right? Like going to, it's a dream for most sports fans, especially golf fans, but just to watch it on TV, there's that. It's just so green and you can hear birds chirping. You got Jim Nance, hello friends. And it's kind of the sound of spring. And so the Masters was yesterday for a little while, it got close, but in the end, Scottie Scheffler, the number one golfer in the world, kind of ran away with it, won it by 4 strokes, and He is living it up right now. But here's the question that many people were pondering on Saturday, apart from the golf. Scottie Scheffler's wife, Meredith, was not at the tournament because she is 38 weeks pregnant. So, Scottie Scheffler, the Masters is undoubtedly the biggest tournament of the year. But your wife is pregnant with your first child. He doesn't have any other children. This is their first child. And so the question became, what will you, Scottie Scheffler, number one player in the world at the biggest tournament there is, what will you do if your wife back home goes into labor? So before I play you the clip in which Scottie Scheffler will answer that question, what would you do? So it becomes easy to categorize it, at least with a golf, being as a professional golfer. Okay, it's the biggest tournament of the year, but maybe at your work, it's, you know, the biggest conference that you host or this big meeting, or for us at church as a pastor, maybe it's Easter Sunday or some big outreach you're doing. What would you do if your wife was pregnant with your first child and it coincided with the pinnacle kind of your career? What would you do? Now, he ended up not needing to make the choice. His wife did not go into labor, and so he was able to not have to make that choice. But I want you to listen. Scottie Scheffler talked in the weeks leading up and in the afternoon right before the Masters and during the Masters. Actually, the clip I'm about to play to you was after he was leading the tournament. So winning was there was a chance he was going to win. Listen to what Scottie Scheffler says.
You and your wife, Meredith, are expecting your first child. You've maintained throughout the week, if you get a call, you're gone. Are you still saying that going into the final round?
Yeah, I'm sticking my word. You know, fortunately, I'll be here at the Masters for quite some time. And, yeah, I think you only have your first child once, so I'd rather be at home if that's going to happen.
How much does that impending news sort of take your mind off what's going on in the golf tournament, though? How much can that at least relax you because you're not thinking only about golf?
Yeah. Meredith and I are both at a very exciting time in our lives, and we're excited to start the new journey of parenthood together. And it's been fun so far, and you know, we're looking forward to getting that baby out of Mary's belly and into the world.
He makes no bones about it. Scheffler says, I could be on the back nine on Sunday with the lead. If I get word from my wife that she is going into labor, I'm going home. I'm leaving the course and going home. And I love his reasoning. He's going to play in a lot more Masters tournaments. This is the only time his first child is born. What do you think about what he said there? What do you think about what his plan was? Again, he never had to execute it because his wife did not go into labor while he was playing. But what if she had? I think this is a wonderful demonstration of priority, of perspective. I think this is a wonderful demonstration for people as to what's important in life. Scheffler says, it doesn't matter what golf tournament it is. It doesn't matter how much money he would have won. And he won, I think yesterday, $3 million for winning the Masters. He's not missing the birth of his first child. And I think we so easily get our perspective wrong around things like this, where we're willing to miss things, not just the birth of our child, but think about the activities of our children or the important things of life, where you look back at the end of your life and you go, man, I really wish I had done this. I really wish I hadn't missed this. But in the moment, you can't miss the Masters. You can't miss that meeting. You can't miss. Yes, you can. Yes, you can. So we set our priorities and we say, this is where I'm going. This is what's important to me. And Scottie Scheffler made it very clear. I am not missing the birth of my first child. I think it would have been fascinating and it would have made so many people debate if he had a 4-shot lead with like 9 holes to go on Sunday and he walked off. I would have had so much respect for that decision, but I don't think it would have been universal. What would you have done? What would you have thought if he had done that? Anyway, congratulations to him on the winning of his second green jacket, the second Masters. We're into that rainy season here in Chicago, right? My son plays baseball. My daughter plays softball. And We're looking at the weather again this week. They got multiple games going. Looks like it might rain some more. Looks like you might have to dance around raindrops. But hey, at least it's getting warmer. And it was a beautiful weekend on Saturday. My daughter had a doubleheader. And the second game, not both games combined, the second game went 3 hours. Got a little sunburned. But hey, they won both of them. So it was a good weekend. All right, big right turn here. Found this over at Religion News. And it's a hard topic, but I think one that we as Christians really need to wrestle with. And as Americans, quite frankly, we need to wrestle with, and that's the death penalty. Over at Religion News, this article, let's see, what was the guy's name? His name is Joe Engel. He's a death row pastor, United Church of Christ minister, and the founder of the Southern Center for Human Rights. He says he is the author of a forthcoming memoir called Too Close to the Flame, With the Condemned Inside the Southern Killing Machine. And so the first part of the article, you can find it over at Religion News. The first part of the article is just horrific stories, to be honest with you, about methodology, about methods of execution, whether it be the electric chair, lethal injection, kind of the new one. Tennessee or Alabama tried earlier this year. And he talks about the experience of what people go through. But you might be thinking to yourself, well, that's not great, but the death penalty is still a needed deterrent or punishment. Kind of fits the crime. So I want to read a little bit of what he says. You do not need to agree with this guy, Joe Engels. You do not, but I do think we all need to ponder, what does it say about us as Americans? What does it say about us as Christians to be pro-death penalty? Where might the problems lie with that? So I want to put these before you. Let you wrestle with it. He writes, during my 45 years ministering to the condemned, I discern that those on death row fall into three distinct categories. Those truly guilty of murder, individuals who are unequivocally innocent, and others sentenced to death after the true perpetrator negotiated a plea deal with prosecutors implicating their co-defendant. So structural inequalities, he writes, within the legal system perpetuate a cycle of injustice. That those who end up being killed are most likely to have the worst lawyers, that most of them cannot afford quality legal counsel. He says, across the South, everyone I've met on death row has been poor. Think about that. He's done this for 45 years. He says, across the South, everyone I have met on death row has been poor. In addition, studies show that those in poverty are much more likely to actually be executed, and that there's also a racial component to that. These condemned to die have been, he writes, women, men, the mentally ill, the truly insane. Almost all have suffered from horrific childhood experiences, he writes. Many of them have suffered from trauma and brain damage, yet, he writes, I have found each of to be responsive to caring, concern, and empathy. Although our criminal legal system wishes to designate them to the scrap heap, Joe Engel writes, I have experienced these people to be thoughtful, engaging, funny, and responsible human beings confined to cages. And despite their circumstances, those on death row retain their humanity and deserve to be treated with dignity and compassion. When we lose the perspective that each individual is a child of God, we can do terrible things to one another. Yes, many on death row have committed murder, but none of us should be defined by the worst thing we have done, nor our humanity forfeited because of it. That's Joe Engel, death row pastor, author of a forthcoming memoir called Too Close to the Flame, With the Condemned Inside the Southern Killing Machine. So what do you think? Is execution of those who have committed the worst of the crimes, murder, is that enough for you? Is it a deterrent? Is it a rightful punishment, eye for an eye? How do you think about that? Or, as he points out, are the inconsistencies literally that we have, we know we've executed innocent people? And also the disparities, socioeconomic disparities, poor people get executed much more than rich people, racial disparities, black people and those minorities get executed much more than white people. Do those cause you pause? I have to be honest, as I've considered this, as I've weighed this, I think that even if we got it perfectly right, even if we if there was a system somehow where we could only execute people who were undoubtedly guilty of heinous crimes, I still think that it's anti-gospel. I still think that it's not the way of Jesus. And I think he gets at it the last paragraph here, Joe Engel. When we lose the perspective that each individual is a child of God, we could do terrible things to one another. None of us should be defined by the worst thing we have done, nor our humanity forfeited because of it. You just hear stories right now of people being finding redemption and forgiveness and transformation while on death row, while in prison. Follow my old co-host and friend Ian Simpkins, what they're seeing at their church, Calvin University, Hope College, other places that are going into prisons and seeing life transformation, people being changed. And so what it really comes down to then, I guess, is our desire for vengeance. And again, thankfully, I've never gone through anything like this. And my guess is if I, heaven forbid, ever had to go through a situation where a loved one was killed, was murdered, I'd want vengeance. So I'm not suggesting that this isn't a human desire. But when we proclaim to be pro-life, how's the death penalty fit into that? When we proclaim to be to see everybody made in the image of God, how does the death penalty play into that? When we say that no sin outlasts or goes further than the grace and the forgiveness found in the cross of Jesus Christ, how's the death penalty play into that? Especially when we see that studies don't show that it is at all a deterrent. So if it's not actually deterrent, then what is it? I think it's a means of vengeance. And I don't know that we as Christians are supposed to have that as part of our character. What does it mean that even the worst of the worst is created in the image of God, and that Jesus went to the cross for them? Great perspective there from Joe Engel. I look forward to his forthcoming memoir, Too Close to the Flame, with the condemned inside the Southern killing machine. I think that's going to be an interesting read, to say the least. Me and my son and my brother-in-law, we were having a little debate yesterday about our favorite sandwich shops, like not like your local deli, but Subway, Jimmy John's. In fact, we listed four of them. I wonder how you would rate them. We went Subway, Jimmy John's, Subway, Jimmy John's, Jersey Mike's, Potbelly's. How would you rank those four? Think about that for a second. I went Potbelly's 1, Jersey Mike's 2, Jimmy John's 3, Subway 4. Ironically, all four of us had Subway 4th. My son went Jimmy John's. Oh, no, my son also went Popeye's 1, but went Jimmy John's 2. So you could tell I'm hungry right now. Just got me thinking about that. Love a good sandwich. And it's an interesting thing to think about. Where would you go first? Okay, retirement. Let's talk retirement. Chuck Swindoll, well-known pastor. In fact, a couple years ago on this show, we did the Mount Rushmore of evangelical American pastors. And you know, it was Aubrey and I, we debated it at the time. Tony Evans, I think, was on there for both of us. Rick Warren. And then there were some debates, but Chuck Swindoll, I believe, ended up on mine, along with Max Lucado. So Chuck Swindoll's a big deal. He's also 89 years old. So we read this over Christianity Today. Chuck Swindoll has said that pastors, quote, should never retire. We're going to circle back to that. And the 89-year-old won't be stepping away from the pulpit, even as his church welcomes his successor. Stonebriar Community Church in Frisco, Texas, announced last week that Swindoll will transition to founding pastor, but he's going to continue to preach on Sunday as Jonathan Murphy becomes its senior pastor on May 1st. Swindoll said in a video clip along with Murphy, this is a very unique way of expanding, of moving into another chapter, as we often call it here. With over 60 years in ministry, Swindoll is the oldest mega church pastor in the country and one of the most influential. He has been vocal about his plans to remain active in ministry until his death. He said at age 75, this is now he's 89, but at 75, he said, one of my great goals in life is to live long enough to where I'm in the pulpit, preaching my heart out, and I die on the spot. My chin hits the pulpit, boom, and I'm down and out. What a way to die. All right, that's kind of melancholy, kind of dark, but kind of cool. We did that story a couple weeks ago, talking about the story of President Edmund over at Wheaton College years and years ago, back in the 60s, when he died after giving a chapel message in the same way. Murphy said, we have the founding pastor being able to continue to preach as long as the Lord would have, and I can have a season as a senior pastor, taking responsibility for the staff and caring for them and the ministry direction of the church at large. They've been preparing for this transition for several years. And so they've been moving in this direction. It's interesting. Warren Bird, who wrote the book on pastoral succession, that they've written that an intentional overlap plan seems to be the strongest model for its transition. And he says, oftentimes preaching is the last duty for an aging pastor to relinquish. So a couple points here. First of all, Chuck Swindoll, just a superstar. He should be able to do whatever it is he wants. But what do you think about his idea that pastors should not retire? That pastors should not retire. As a pastor who is saving for retirement, I think I agree with him and disagree with him. Disagree with the concept. Now, my guess is he would nuance this, and he's even living into this a little bit right now. I think that we as pastors, and here, this expands to all of us. I don't think retirement is the goal. Retirement shouldn't be the goal. But also, I don't know that we need to live till our dying breath pastoring a specific church for 40 to 50 hours a week. I think we can transition, much like Swindoll is doing here, we can transition into other ministry. We could transition into, and I knew some pastors who have retired and they've gone into the interim transition pastor role. I know others who have kind of give pulpit fill. I do think, and you could see the stuff Swindoll's giving up here from his church. He's giving up the day-to-day staff oversight, ministry oversight. Like, he's just going to preach. It's what he does best, but also it's probably what's most life-giving for him. And I think that's an acknowledgement that while pastors shouldn't necessarily retire, like hang it up and go live on the beach and collect seashells, to quote the old John Piper book, Don't Waste Your Life, it doesn't need to look the same. And I think this is true for everybody. I think this is an across-the-board deal, that retirement cannot be the ultimate goal. retirement can't be the ultimate goal. In by which we mean just putting your feet up and just living completely for yourself. Jesus tells a parable in the book of Luke of the man who has so much stuff, he has to build a bigger barn. That's the American dream. This guy did it. He invested. He got it. He had to build the bigger barn. And then he says, I'm gonna sit here and enjoy the rest of my life. I'm going to put my feet up and eat, drink, and be merry, right? Like I've lived the American dream. And this guy is called a fool. That's the Bible's wordage for it, not mine. He's a fool. And his life was going to be taken from him even that night. What good was his second barn of things when his life was no more? Friends, as Christians, pastors or not pastors, as Christians, our goal is to be eternally focused, is to be laying up treasures in heaven, whether we're working 50 hours a week in our 40s or whether we're retired in our 70s. It's still to have the mindset that says, until my dying breath, as much as I'm physically and mentally able, I'm going to point people to Jesus. I'm going to be a witness to the gospel. I'm going to be an ambassador of Christ. And if that means pastoring a church, so be it. If that means working in or supporting a ministry, so be it. If that means helping churches, you know, consulting, or it could take any form. But our culture tells us the ultimate goal is retirement. That's not biblical. Now, the beautiful thing of retirement is it gives you more time, kind of more autonomy over your time. But don't use that autonomy of time to just go do whatever you want and be self-serving, like to just do what you want for yourself. Instead, use that time in creative, God-honoring, kingdom-advancing ways, much like Chuck Swindoll is still doing here as he transitions into just kind of a founding pastor role. I wasn't here on Friday, so I wasn't able to comment on the passing of O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson. What a weird, evil, tragic, strange life that man lived. And I remember, you know, the juice, right? OJ first was a great football player, then an actor. He was such a big, you can forget how big a deal OJ was. He was like one of the first kind of crossover movie kind of entertainment stars from being an athlete. And then that fateful June day in 1994, the white Bronco chase. That was my junior year of high school. I just finished my junior year. And then the trial was all my senior year. And I remember I was taking a class called Criminal Justice my senior year of high school. And I was obsessed with the OJ trial. And it went so long that the verdict didn't come till first semester of my freshman year at Wheaton College. And for many, like many of you, I remember literally where I was the moment that I found out about that verdict, where I was on campus. I can picture it clear as day when he was declared not guilty. When, I mean, let's be honest, even those who were happy that he was acquitted knew that he was guilty. If that happened now with DNA evidence, it would have been undoubtedly, but this was a transformational cultural event. It in many ways gave rise to cable news. Places like CNN leaned into this. It gave rise to what later became social media. It showed the fracturing along racial lines in our country at the time. It was another sign of it. And then there were just cultural moments, the white Ford Bronco chase. If the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit. And there was Mark Furman. And there was just, it felt like for many people, the O.J. Simpson case became a referendum on race in America, not did he kill his wife and the guy who just happened to be bringing her glasses back to her house for her. And so DoJ Simpson didn't spend any time in prison for that, but ended up going to prison later in life over a robbery, but passes away this past week at the age of 76. And crazy. I mean, it's just people don't know how to talk about him on his death because the fame, you know, like the NFL Hall of Fame as a thing, when a Hall of Famer dies, they lower the flag, they, you know, write a sympathy tweet or whatever. And they did that for OJ because he's in the Hall of Fame. A lot of people had a problem with that. It's complicated, but a cultural touch point. I remember where I was when the Challenger exploded. I remember where I was when the OJ verdict came down. I remember where I was on 9/11. And then there are some others along the way, but those are some of the biggies for my generation. OJ Simpson passing away at the age of 76. Okay. Wanted to make sure to mention that one. But let's talk about this. The age of the earth. Does it matter? You do talk to especially some more fundamentalist people, Christians, and they will say, you must believe in a young earth, 6,000 years old. But then you get people and scientists and others who go, but all the data, all the scientific, you know, the fossil records or things in creation point to a world that's billions of years old. So there's a big discrepancy there, right? Is the earth 6,000 years old or is it billions of years old? And I'm not going to answer that. What I want to answer is, does it matter? Where you land on that, does it matter? Over at BeliefNet, they wrote a quick article that got me thinking about that, about how old is the earth. And they answer this to what can we know just about age of the earth. The Bible's clear on some topics, they write. For example, it discusses the method of salvation and our moral obligations in great detail. However, the Bible doesn't give as much information on other topics. One of the topics the Bible doesn't explicitly address is the earth's age. One method to determine the earth's age assumes that the 6 days of creation in Genesis 1 were 24-hour periods with no gaps in the genealogy or chronology of Genesis. Then the years listed in genealogies of Genesis are added to get an approximate time from creation to specific Old Testament figures. The earth would then be 6,000 years old using this method. However, it's important to note that this is a calculated number, not one that the Bible gives. Another method to determine the earth's age is using resources like geologic cycles, carbon dating, etc. Scientists try to determine how old the planet is by comparing different methods and seeing if they match. According to this method, the earth is between 4 and 5 billion years old. Again, this is a calculated number, not one the Bible gives. And they conclude this way. The Bible doesn't explicitly state the earth's age. The earth's age does not affect one's view of morality, sin, salvation, heaven, or hell. However, the Bible does discuss who created the world, why he created it, and how we were meant to relate to him. I think that's the answer. It does not matter. It is not essential where you land on Earth's age. What is essential, what you cannot back off of, is who created the world. It's not about how God created the world. It's that God created the world. Anything that removes God as the author of creation and of humanity needs to be rejected. But then we get lost on these conversations about how exactly 6 literal days versus periods of time. We get lost in these and we miss the bigger point. That God created, that sin entered the world, that God brought salvation. It's the same thing with the end of the world. It doesn't matter, in my opinion, how it happens. But it does matter that Jesus is returning. In victory, to rule and to reign. Like, you see the difference? We get so lost with our charts and our books and our, oh, I'm all millennial, I'm post-millennial, I'm pre-millennial, I'm this and that. It's, we don't know. But we can proclaim with certainty that Jesus Christ will return in victory and power to rule and reign for all of eternity, that he will sit on the throne. It matters that God created. Not how, not the timing. It matters that Jesus is coming back. Not how, not the timing. Let's keep the major thing the major thing. Do you agree with me on that? Do you agree that that it doesn't matter how old the age of the earth is? That fundamentally that doesn't change anything. I wonder if you agree. There are some people I know, this is a biggie. And this is not, they're not willing to make that same call. I just, it's where kind of I land on that. It could be weird sometimes, but to just talk into a microphone. It could be odd. If you've never had that experience, it could be odd sometimes because you know that people are listening, but you can't see them. Like, one of my favorite things about preaching at a church is the ability to see. It's the ability to connect with people. It's the ability to make that eye contact and get that nonverbal or verbal response. That's one of the great joys. And so radio is different. You go into a studio and you talk and talk and talk and talk, and then the microphone gets turned off and you go on with your day. And so to know who the people are out there who are listening is always fun to hear. It's always fun when people come up and like, hey, I was listening to your show, or hey, I enjoy listening to your show, or it's always enjoyable. So, hey, for my own sake, as a words of affirmation person, if you could write us back, give me a little note, that would be wonderful. I'll write you back. I promise. I'll send you something back. Much appreciated. Okay. Bill Maher, comedian, but also talk show host, right? Like, he has a very well-watched show. He tends to be very opinionated, one of the right words, but he really stirs the pot on both sides of the aisle. And he said something about abortion the other day, that if you're pro-abortion or pro-choice, I've told you, I'm not sure I believe in pro-choice anymore. It feels like it's either pro-life or pro-abortion. I don't believe that pro-choice necessarily exists much, at least in our politics. He said something the other day about that shouldn't get both sides of the aisle thinking. What do pro-choice people really think? And what do pro-life people actually think, right? He calls into question people who are willing to to leave it to the states, like President Trump said the other day, or to leave it up to a certain number of weeks or a certain number of exceptions. So I want you to listen to what he said. I want you to think about it and try to process it. Let's process together. This is Bill Maher.
Not if you believe it's murder. You know, that's why I don't understand the 15-week thing, or the Trump's plan is let's leave it to the states. You mean, so killing babies is okay in some states? Like, I can respect the absolutist position. I really can. I scold the left on when they say, oh, you know what? They just hate women, people who aren't pro-life, pro-choice. They don't hate women. They just made that up. They think it's murder. And it kind of is. I'm just okay with that. I am. I mean, there's 8 billion people in the world. I'm sorry. We won't miss you. That's my position on it. What?
That's quite harsh, Bill.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not
Is
sure
that not your
much.
Position if you're pro-choice?
Isn't that mainly because you don't like children? I mean,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
No. I mean, but if you are, you said you're pro-choice. That's your position too.
All right, let's just talk about what he said. Let's synthesize what he said. First of all, he said to the pro-life people, I don't understand how you're good with like a 15-week. If abortion is murder, I don't understand how you're good leaving it to the states, because therefore some states can do it and some states can't. And he said, I actually respect the absolutists. An absolutist would say all abortion is murder and therefore should be not just eliminated, but it's also oftentimes the absolutist who want to provide penalties to those who get abortions or provide abortions. I agree with him and don't agree with him. I do agree with him that abortion needs to be viewed from that standpoint. It's not a political hot potato. It's not a political issue to which points can be won. This is a matter of life and death. Now, the absolutist position versus, say, 15 weeks or 6 weeks, or in an ideal world, I agree with him. But we don't live in an ideal world. So sometimes you have to take the gains that you can get and live to fight another day. Like if it's no abortion after, say, 10 weeks or no restrictions at all, and at a specific slice in time, that's your only option, then make the gains you can and continue to fight to see the day when abortion's gone altogether. But this cannot be a political hot button topic. I've said this many times on the show. If this costs votes, that's okay. It's okay. Because we need to be pro-life is to say my priority is the life of the baby and the life of the mother. We know the statistics also, the anecdotal evidence as well, that abortions hurt moms physically, psychologically. This is not a net zero thing. And so we want to make sure that that's known, and we want to care for moms. That's why we always say, support your local crisis pregnancy center. But then the shocking thing that he said there, he's a pro-choice guy, and he says, yeah, it's murder. I'm just okay with it. If you're out there and you're pro-abortion, what do you think about what he said there? He said that he's pro-choice and that it's fallacy to say pro-life people don't care about women. I couldn't agree with that more for reasons we just said, but also just, I think that's just a smokescreen. Like this is either care for the baby or care for the mom. I don't believe that dichotomy is true. But friends, did you pick up what he said? He said, pro-choice people know that it's murder. We're just okay with it. With a population of 8 billion people, we won't miss you. Sorry. Unreal. That is saying the quiet part out loud. Hey, we know we're killing a baby here. We know we're killing a life. We're just okay with it. On some level, you have to thank him for his honesty. But friends, if we ever think that this is just an issue of choices and it's not. The reason we feel strongly about the abortion debate is because it is legitimately a matter of life and death. We can have conversations about how things are changed. We can have conversations about laws, all of these things, but don't lose the major point of what's going on here. And Bill Maher, very much pro-choice. Pierce Morgan, who was there, that was the guy you heard laughing. Did you like that awkward laughing going on as well with the studio? They all owned up to it. And I think that that is a wake-up call again for all of us. It's a beautiful day out there today. I know there's some rain coming, but hopefully get outside, go for a walk, enjoy God's creation. You know, I love to go for walks, and when I go for walks by myself, I find that to be the best time for me to pray. Kind of look up in the sky. We don't have a lot in Illinois that like screams creation, right? We don't have mountains. We don't have the ocean. You can look up into the sky. Look at the new life around you as the grass grows and the buds are the flowers are budding, and you could thank God for new creation. The old is gone, the new has come. That's the picture of the seasons that we get. The old, the death of autumn and winter. New life, the new has come. The springing forth of spring at this time of year. And we can thank God for it. Go for a walk today. Sit outside. Do something outside and go, thank you, Lord. Thank you, God, for the new life that we have in Christ. Allow the new life of creation around us to remind us of the new life that we have in Jesus Christ. While we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. The old is gone and the new has come. It's truly good news. Well, I was on Twitter and I saw a pastor, looks like he had a Christ Community Church in Charlotte, North Carolina, named Ronnie Parrott. Ronnie Parrott wrote this on Twitter. Another pastor was removed for sexual misconduct last week. Well-loved by the church, had a large online platform. He preached Jesus. Church was growing. This becomes the difficulty. He's going to get into then the answer. But isn't this what's difficult every time we see these stories? Like, let's focus on the church here. This pastor wasn't, apparently, I don't even know who the pastor is. Church loved this pastor. He had a large online platform, so he was having fruitful ministry. So well-loved, fruitful, focused on Jesus, preaching Jesus. And the church seemed to be healthily growing. There was much fruit in the church. These are all the markers that we normally have of a successful ministry. Well-loved, large platform, preaching Jesus, growing church. If you write that on your Twitter bio as a pastor, done. That works. That's what makes some of these, when you read these, so discouraging. Because sometimes with certain pastors, you're like, sadly, I'm not surprised by that. But this sounds like one that caught people off guard, sexual misconduct. And so Ronnie Parrott's second part goes like this. Character in leadership is not a second tier issue. Count the cost of sin. All right, he's still going to have more here, but let's talk about that. I love the way he wrote that. Character in leadership is not a second tier issue. The implication there is it's a first tier issue. Usually in leadership, our first tier issues with pastors are leadership. Can they lead? Preaching. Are they charismatic? Can they preach? Shepherding. All of these different things. There's some things that where there's some markers that if you think about, what do we want in our pastor? Okay, character and leadership. Character. I wouldn't even call this a first tier issue. I would call this whatever the top tier, whatever the top of the top of the top is. That's what this is. Character in leadership. Character. Integrity. But oftentimes in churches, we will look past it, make it a second tier issue because pastor has a well-loved church, a large platform, preaching Jesus, growing church. But Ronnie Parrott goes on to say, count the cost of sin. Let's broaden this far away from just the church. Friends, in your life, no matter what you do, character is not a second tier issue. Character is the main issue. Morality, character, integrity is a first tier top tier issue. Count the cost of sin, he says. Count the cost of sin. Understand all that it will rob from you. And then he gives four very short, somewhat pithy suggestions. if you're going to get this right. Call a friend, confess, get help, be holy. Call a friend, confess, get help, be holy. Why call a friend? Bringing stuff from darkness into light. Bear one another's burden. Pray for one another. The prayer of a righteous person is powerful and effective. But when you call that friend, then confess. Here's what I've done. Here's what I'm thinking of doing. Here's where I'm heading in my life. Make sure there's somebody close to you who knows what's going on in your life. Get help. What's the core issue that you're hiding from, that you're running from? Who do you need to talk to? How do you deal with whatever it is of the fruit of which is lack of character, lack of integrity? I don't believe we go from God-honoring lives with high character and good morals and healthy marriage and set to the next day going, you know what, I'm going to have an affair. There's something going on inside. There's a rot inside our souls. We confess it. We repent. We bring it into the light. And then we get the help we need. And then his words, be holy. Go live out your life. Be holy as I am holy, Jesus says. Or scripture says. Call a friend, confess, get help, be holy. Friends, until we fully believe, that character is not just a, but maybe the primary issue of leadership, of life, of faith, we'll never take it seriously. We'll cover things up in our lives. Be a man or a woman of high character. And where that's not happening, count the cost of sin. Call a friend. Confess. Get help. Be holy. These things don't have to just happen. But we can take seriously what's going on in our own soul. Scott Sauls over at his blog, scottsauls.com, wrote this, Jesus and the myth that, quote, good will ever be good enough. And he said, the bar for heaven's entry is so low that only a few will reach it. Let me begin reading and then we'll stop along the way and kind of make points in this. He writes, several years ago, a famous politician made a stunning statement as he reflected on his own legacy at the age of 72. He spoke about initiatives he'd spearheaded and listed several of his own successes, both real and self-perceived. The surprising part of his speech was the takeaway in which he speculated about the afterlife. He said, I'm telling you, if there is a God, when I get to heaven, I'm not stopping to be interviewed. I'm heading straight in. I've earned my place in heaven. It's not even close. Sauls continues. When I first heard this statement, it dawned on me that Christianity is the most unique religion in the world. Why? Because Christianity offers no option for behaving, achieving, or performing our way into the afterlife. With Jesus, heaven's door opens to us at the beginning of our journey, not at the end. It's based on invitation and love, not merit. The door is Jesus himself. He lived the life we should have lived, but didn't. And he died the death we should have died, but will never have to. Jesus lived and died in our place. And he rose from the dead to seal our redemption and our future. Other religions say what the politician said of himself. If you want to get to heaven, you have to accomplish something. You have to live up to something. You have to bring it. For self-aware individuals, this is a more terrifying thought than it is comforting. Even Karl Marx recognized this. In a rare moment of transparency, Marx disclosed an inner thought that influenced the destructive worldview he would come to espouse. Reflecting on his own struggle for, quote, salvation or significance or identity, or whatever we may call it, Marx said this, I am nothing and I should be everything. Man, the poor, denuded creature must repress his smallness. Sauls continues, the aforementioned politician, and Marx are saying the same thing from different angles. The politician from a place of superiority and feeling strong, and Marx from a place of inferiority and feeling weak. Both assume the way to salvation is through work, through exertion, through human effort, through fulfilled expectation. The thinking is that we start off small and we work and strive into our potential. In the end, this effort will determine our salvation or our judgment, depending on how we have performed. It will also be our ticket to being accepted by God if we believe God exists, but also accepted by others and by ourselves. Do you ever wonder, Sauls asks, where the ache to be declared, quote, good comes from? What is it that attracts us to things like having our names remembered on a building or in a history book or on a donor list or on a book cover or a record label or by an industry or by our descendants? Do you ever wonder where the drive to accomplish something significant comes from? But what if your name has already been given to you? And your legacy has already been settled? What if God has already given you that name and that legacy, and the purpose of your life is to live from that name versus living towards it? God has given you that name and legacy. It's already yours. In fact, it's been yours since the beginning of time. Jesus Christ lived and died. He made himself nothing so you would never have to feel like a nothing. He became small so you would never have to repress your smallness. He rose from the grave so you could get to heaven and walk right in and not have to stop for an interview, not because of what you brought to the table to validate yourself, but because of what Jesus brought to the table to secure your validation. Because your trial has already happened, heaven's court is adjourned and a perfect record has been established on your behalf by another. Sauls ends this way. It bears repeating that the door of heaven's entry opens to you at the start of your journey, not at the end. God does not ask you to be amazing. Instead, he asks you to be humble, faithful, forgiven, free. And when you struggle even with these things, he has you covered. Leave the awesome to Jesus. When you do, you will also become the best version of yourself, but without the pressure. Amazing words there by Scott Sauls. How do you live that way? There's the question before us today. How do we truly live as if we do not need to prove ourselves to God? How do we truly live out of our identity, not instead trying to form our identity or trying to establish our identity? How do we grasp the grace that says, all that I needed was won for me at the cross, at the beginning, not at the end, not at the end where I go, okay, I earned it. I lived it out. That's in many ways the struggle of the Christian life. We know this. By grace you have been saved, not by works. Like, we know this. Then we go on trying to perform, trying to please God, trying to impress God. And the rat race continues. Look at me, I'm so righteous. The older brother in the story of the prodigal son. Look what I've done. Friends, Christianity is not a religion of look at what I've done. It's a religion of look at what Jesus has already done. And that is an enormous difference. The look at what I've done puts the pressure on us to perform. The look at what Jesus has already done gives us the freedom to live obediently and passionately and worshipfully, fully following him out of thankfulness. Because our identity is secure. Do you believe that your identity in Christ is secure? If so, be reminded of it. Live out of it. Don't try to perform. Don't try to live up to something. Instead, lean into something. That being the amazing grace of Jesus Christ. Grateful to have you with us on this tax day. Are you one of those people who's waited to the very, very, very end to get your taxes in? Hopefully you get them in. Get them in today. And I hope you're getting a refund. Not that the tax man is coming for you, but instead, maybe you're coming for the tax man. So glad that you are with us today. I want to end our show kind of devotionally, kind of encouraging us from the words of Tim Challies. There's certain, if you listen to the show, you know there's certain blogs or certain writers or certain Twitter accounts we go to often. And one of them is Tim Challies, challies.com, C-H-A-L-L-I-E-S, challies.com. A wonderful, one of the first Christian blogs out there and one of the best. And so he's talking in this one about beauty in the whole and the parts. And he begins by talking about some friends of his, a married couple where the husband feels like he has to take things apart to really understand them. Got to deconstruct things, right? He's got to take things apart. Whereas the wife is kind of the opposite. I see the beauty in the full flowers. I don't need to know how it functions. I don't need to know what's below the surface or a machine or a tool or whatever else you can add to that. And he says, I think of them often as I consider the wonderful discipline of theology. In theology, we make a study of God, of his works, and of his ways. With scripture as our guide, with God's revelation of himself as our starting point, we gaze deeply into matters almost too wonderful to behold. And as we study our God, we find there is blessing in the macro and the micro, in the whole and the part. So what does he mean? We come to see that God is triune, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. That they are distinct persons, yet one God. We can go deeper and deeper into the scriptures. We can apply reason and logic and over time arrive at a more confident and developed doctrine of the Trinity. We can ponder how the Father relates to the Son in ways that are distinct from the ways he relates to the Spirit. We can ponder the ways each was present and active in the great work of creation. We can ponder how each plays a role in our redemption. This is good, and such study is rewarding. Yet, Challies writes, it's also good to simply enjoy the Trinity. On the most basic and assembled level, to simply acknowledge God is one and God is three, and that to me is a great mystery. There's a blessing in the whole as much as in the parts. The same is true when we consider the doctrine of salvation. We can map out a whole logical sequence of events that took place to draw us from darkness to light. We can debate the exact order of the steps. We can refine our terminology. We can do our best to reconcile the sovereignty of God with the responsibility of man. All of this is a good and spiritually rewarding study. Yet sometimes we also do well to step back and simply say, God is sovereign, man is responsible, and for today I'm content to simply affirm those two statements as friends rather than enemies. There's a beauty in the most basic whole as much as in the most advanced parts. And Challies concludes this way. There are some who are like my friend and are only content when they've gone as deep as they can, when they've taken a doctrine apart and put it back together. There are some, like my friend's wife, who are content to take a doctrine at face value and not invest substantial effort in going endlessly deeper. Both approaches are good. Both approaches are right. And both approaches are rewarding in their own way, for both reveal God's beauty and God's glory. I never really thought of it this way. But I think Challies is 100% right here. Sometimes it's great to just unpack and debate and unpack and keep going and tear apart some more. And I want to understand exactly how theology or, salvation works. Is it God's initiative? Is it our initiative? How exactly does it work? And that's good. those debates, that study, they are all good. But then, is it sometimes good to just say, this is a mystery, but I'm thankful for my salvation, and I'm going to lean into that. He said the Trinity. That is probably the one that we all probably jumped to when we heard this kind of laying out. How exactly does the Trinity work? What does the Spirit do? What does the Son do? What does the Father do? What does it mean that they are three in one, three distinct, but one? And that's a good debate. That's a good discussion. Sometimes it's also good to just say, the mystery of the Trinity is indeed a mystery, but I'm thankful for it. Is that also okay? Yes. I like this route he's taken because I think sometimes I think about the whole more than the parts. I don't enjoy the debates and the micro, like, I got to figure this out. I'll do it. But even back in college, that was never my thing. I'm okay with the mystery of the Trinity or of salvation. And so the part for me is to go, okay, but sometimes you need to go micro. Sometimes you need to unpack and dive in. And others of you just get paralyzed by, I need to understand this more and more and more. And sometimes you need to step back and just see the beauty of the whole. Wow, God has saved me. Well, the triune God is at work on my behalf. Because he loves me. The micro and the macro, the big picture and the details. Which one do you tend towards? What does it look like for you to step back and kind of engage in the other? We're wired differently. We all are. His example here is even a husband and wife wired in the opposite way with this. But it's good to think about where our muscles are weak, what we're not good at. What can it teach me about God as I do the hard work of being a macro person, focusing on the micro, being a micro person, focusing on the macro. Great words there by Tim Challies. Beauty in the whole and beauty in the parts. We're glad that you joined us today. Join us again tomorrow. From 4 until 6 p.m. Until then, I hope that you have a wonderful day. Go for a walk. Beautiful out. Go for a walk. Spend that time with your family or spend that time praying as you walk and be thankful for God's wonderful creation. The old is gone. The new has come. New life is springing forth, much like new life sprang forth when Jesus came out of that tomb. And because of that, we have life. Glad that you joined us again. Join us again tomorrow from 4 until 6. My name is Brian Fromm. You've been listening to The Common Good on AM 1160. Hope for your life.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.